Big news! Wayfair's Black Friday sale is here, early. Right now at Wayfair, get up to 70% off everything you need for the season ahead. Save on kitchen and dining, bedroom furniture and mattresses, holiday decor, and way more. Now is the time to score big, from seasonal finds to favorites you'll use all year long. Plus, with Wayfair, enjoy fast and easy shipping, with delivery in time for the holidays. Save up to 70% off early Black Friday deals. Shop now at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Hey, everybody. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome to Beekeeping for Newbies. Thank you very, very much for taking the time to listen. I do appreciate you. And as always, feel free to reach out, Jeff, at beekeeping4newbies.com. It's N-E-W-B-E-E-S.com. And I do apologize if you go to the website right now, for whatever reason, my hosting provider is having some kind of a catastrophic failure, and I see nothing. And the only message that's on the website right now says database connection lost. So that's pretty exciting that they probably got hacked and took down the whole hosting provider. So the website should be back up one of these days here, and I don't know what's going on there. We'll have to harass them about that later on. And today's warm-up song is Love Me Tender by The King. Yes, Elvis Presley. Okay, I wanted to send out a congratulations. The voting is done, and everything has been announced. So you all have won. You have been voted the best-looking Bee podcast listeners globally. So congrats to all of you on that. It's a big accomplishment in a very competitive space. So nice work. Okay, today what we're going to do is it's episode 180, and we're following up on last week. We were talking about Pennsylvania's Plant and Pollinator Protection Act, and I referenced in the previous episode, I referenced Senate Bill 1198, and that was the 2024 bill that went before the Senate in Pennsylvania. Now in 2025 is House Bill 1277. And I wanted to talk to you kind of about the differences between the two and why we're even doing a follow-up at all. So we had a lot of questions about last week's episode around a lot of the legislative process and how urgent everything is, what the level of kind of oh crap factor is that we're kind of looking at with this whole thing. So I thought it might make sense to do kind of two things today. One is it's sort of a bit of a correction, because what I was bringing up in the last episode, I said, hey, this is current legislation, this is active, and that's not really true. I'll explain that in the next few minutes here. I'll explain the replacement bill that is, in fact, active. We'll do the breakdown of what happened with the last bill and the expiration of that. We're going to talk about what the risk-based inspections are, because this is important in the way that it's been discussed across the two. We'll talk about what new powers the department's going to have to enter property and to destroy colonies, how the fee system quietly expanded a little bit to include some new revenue streams, the types of penalties and daily fines that are now going to be on the table with this new bill, and how the bill gives us, or gives the state, exclusive authority over pollinators, plants, and even, you know, your kind of day-to-day beekeeping practices. So hopefully by the end of all of this, it'll be a much clearer picture of where everything stands, what's changed, what to look for next. And of course, as this moves forward, we really want to track it nationally, even potentially globally, to see how things like this could shape the activities of other states and how they handle beekeeping regulation in the future. You know, it's going to be really important because, like we talked about, once one state adopts something, it tends to be a little bit easier for another state to point and say, well, they did it. Where we're going to start, though, is by walking through the Pennsylvania legislative process, how that works, and kind of how you can understand where the bill stands, how fast it could move, and what opportunities there are for public input before it becomes law. And I think this goes back to kind of like a, I don't know, middle school, high school, you know, legislative kind of class, you know, in civics or in any kind of, you know, U.S. history and how these things work. I never remember this. I can never keep track of what happens when and where. I recognize you have like a House and the Senate, and each one can propose different things, and they go through their processes and they pass it to each other and they make changes, and you know, they do a lot of things to justify their existence and creating more jobs and creating more ways to spend your money and all those kind of cool things. I just always forget how it works. So we're going to just walk through that for anybody who really doesn't care to dive into the details of this. We'll walk through that whole process as well today and explain that. So let's start with how we got from the 2024 legislation, which is what I was really discussing last week, to the 2025. So any proposed bill in Pennsylvania's General Assembly. It's going to be tied to a specific two-year legislative session. If that session ends before a bill is passed in both chambers and signed by the governor, it simply expires. It doesn't carry over automatically. That's what happened with Senate Bill 1198 from 2024. It reached committee review, but it never advanced for a vote before the session ended, so it officially died, you know, with adjournment. Now, once a bill expires, the concept behind it can still be revived in a new session, but it must be reintroduced as a brand new bill, often under a different, you know, different number or even in the opposite chamber, as what happened here with this situation. So in this case, the Pennsylvania Department of Agriculture, it didn't drop the idea. They worked with the staff and the legislative sponsors to repackage and reintroduce the same framework in the 2025-2026 session as House Bill 1277. The shift from a Senate bill, SB 1198, to a House bill, HB 1277, doesn't mean it was picked up and moved. It means there's a new sponsor in the House who has taken the lead, likely using updated language provided by the department after some stakeholder feedback, internal review, and other pressure maybe to refine the bill in some way. So those revisions are often drafted by the same legal staff and the same legislative reference bureau. You know, they're the ones who are taking departmental input, committee notes, lobbyist recommendations, you know, beekeeping associations, anyone who might be involved. And then they're going to rewrite that text before it gets filed again. So the 2025 version isn't completely random. It is a continuation of the same policy agenda from the Department of Agriculture, but with some stronger enforcement language, higher penalties, and some more clear approaches to their kind of funding mechanism. So it's currently sitting in the House Agricultural and Rural Affairs Committee, where it's going to kind of start this process all over again with the hearings, amendments, and ultimately the potential advancement to the floor. Now, in Pennsylvania, any legislator can introduce a bill. So once it's filed, it's read across the desk, it's assigned to a committee. Committees are then going to review everything, they're going to hold hearings, they can amend the bill, and a lot of proposals never even make it out of committee. If it does, the bill goes through three considerations on the floor. The third consideration is the final vote in the chamber. If it passes, it then moves to the other chamber, goes through the exact same process again over there, and then when both chambers agree, it heads to the governor who can sign it, veto it, or let it become law without a signature. That's a goofy thing that states do where they can basically say, like, I want it to become law, but I don't want my name associated with it, something weird like that. The Agriculture and Rural Affairs Committee controls the calendar right now, which means the bill can kind of sit quietly, it can move really fast, kind of depending on political will and pressure. You know, the exact timeline is not crystal clear. So for everyone asking, hey, how urgent is this? The answer is that it's definitely early enough to make some noise. But if it advances out of committee, it can gain momentum very quickly. So you definitely want to be on top of things. So diving into some of the specifics here of these changes. So the basic idea of the shift in House Bill 1277 is that we're going to replace, this is something we discussed last week, we're going to replace the $10 registration fee with a licensing system it's not new, right? This has already been discussed. But what changed in House Bill 1277 is the scope and language around who must be licensed and how that authority is exercised. The 2024 version, it used some broad phrasing that kind of suggested that most beekeepers would fall under the new licensing rule. The 2025 version removes any doubt. It directly defines a pollinator operation as any person managing honeybees for commercial, business, or personal use. So that wording completely eliminates any of the gray area. There's no exception for education programs, backyard beekeepers, non-commercial hobbyists. Everyone falls under the same licensing structure. Now, the new bill does tighten the enforcement mechanism as well. So instead of just saying that licenses may be revoked, House Bill 1277 adds specific conditions under which they shall be suspended or revoked, including unpaid fees, failure to comply with an order, and things like that. So basically what this means is the department kind of has a clearer power to pull your license or shut you down operationally for administrative reasons, not just for disease control. It also expands the department's ability to collect and retain licensing fees, tying them directly to enforcement costs, and, of course, some of those new verification programs that we talked about in the last episode, which wasn't as clearly spelled out as it is now. So the difference really isn't that licensing is going to exist or not exist. It's that it's now written to cover everyone with stronger enforcement, some more financial reach, and not really a clear path for any exemptions or waivers. So I want to talk about the risk-based inspections. This is something that came up last time. A lot of questions came to me around that, and it was definitely kind of a hot topic from the first bill. So the 2024 bill used that phrase, risk-based inspections, and it sounds kind of reasonable on paper, but again, it wasn't really clearly defined. There were no guidelines describing what risk actually meant, no measurable standards for how that risk was going to be scored. It did not mention how a beekeeper could question or correct a bad classification. It was really vague and kind of open-ended. It left everything up to interpretation, which I kind of don't like for legislative types of things. The 2025 bill does not fix that problem. It keeps the same undefined language, adds more authority on top of it. So now the department can increase inspection frequency based on complaints, past inspection results, or a history of non-compliance. So that might sound like accountability, but without clear definitions, it's kind of a blank check to do whatever they want to do. And again, the problem isn't that risk-based inspections should or should not exist or whatever. It's that the law doesn't clearly define what risk is. Is it the number of hives you own? Is it how often you move them? Whether or not you sell honey? Or is it as subjective as an inspector's opinion of what they observed while they were in the area or at your house? Was it a complaint from a neighbor? So until those things are spelled out, you know, in the regulation, risk can kind of mean whatever the department wants it to mean, which is a little bit of a concern to me. Additionally, beekeepers don't have a formal process to appeal or define a high risk designation. So if you're flagged as higher risk, even by mistake, you could face multiple rounds of unannounced inspections every season with no way to clarify how that label was applied or to have it removed. So that's not really transparency in my mind, right? That's an unchecked kind of discretion. I don't really like that. Once a system like this is in place, it definitely will tend to expand. It starts as a tool for identifying pest problems, and it can easily become a mechanism for tracking, targeting, over-inspecting anyone who falls out of favor or doesn't play along with every new rule. So the bottom line here is that while risk-based inspection sounds kind of technical, without some type of a definition or an appeal process, it's not really scientific. It's authoritative without a lot of accountability. So again, something that needs to be clarified, or at least something that I would be pushing to a legislator to say, hey, if you're going to move forward with this, we'd like a little more clarity in some of these spaces. I want to talk about some right of entry, quarantines, and some authority that's introduced here as it relates to the destruction of hives. Now, one of the bigger issues people had with the 2024 bill was how much new authority it gave inspectors to enter the property. The 2025 bill keeps all of that in place, yay, and adds more. So under House Bill 1277, the Department of Agriculture can enter any licensed premises, any vehicle, or any building associated with pollinator operation at any, quote, reasonable time, end quote. They don't need a warrant, and they don't have to schedule in advance. So the only real protection you would have would be like a non-licensed property, but even that's limited, right? The new bill says they can enter non-licensed property if they have, quote, reasonable suspicion of a pest or issue if they're conducting what's called a routine compliance survey. Well, that phrase didn't exist in the 2024 bill, and it's one of the more concerning kind of new additions to this 2025 version. A, quote, routine compliance survey, end quote, could mean pretty much anything. I mean, it could be a random sampling in a geographic area. It can mean checking the yards of anyone near an infected colony. Again, the bill is not defining these limitations. So that means if your neighbor's bees test positive for some kind of a pest, you know, next thing you know, your property is subject to unannounced inspection, even if you're not licensed and don't keep bees. Now, think about that one. You're not even a beekeeper. You're just hanging out, doing your thing, minding your own business, and they decide they want to search your property because you're nearby and you're in close proximity. So this is where the bill's scope kind of really starts to creep a little bit here. And it's written to allow access not to just hives, but any article capable of harboring or transmitting a pest. So that includes hives, equipment, vehicles, storage building, even plants. So there is not a requirement to notify you before entry. There is no mechanism to dispute the inspection after it happens. That's a huge departure from the cooperative model, you know, that Pennsylvania's apiary program used to follow, where inspectors were coordinated and things were educational and again, very cooperative in nature. So talking now about quarantine and some stop orders. So both versions of the bill give the department the power to issue stop orders or quarantine orders when a pest is suspected. The 2025 version keeps that same language, but it adds new penalty section that allows daily fines for every day that the order is violated. That means even if you don't agree with the order and you're trying to appeal it, you can be fined for every day that you fail to comply. It also adds the option for criminal liability for anyone who interferes with or refuses to obey a quarantine or destruction order. That was not in the 2024 version. Quarantine areas can be as small as an apiary or as large as a whole county. The department doesn't need to prove an active infestation. They just need reasonable belief. Reasonable belief is enough to implement that. There's also no guarantee that an order is going to expire at a set time. It can stay in place indefinitely until the department decides to lift it. Now, under the destruction authority, both the 2024 and the 2025 bill give the department the power to destroy bees, hives, and equipment if they believe it's necessary to prevent the spread of pest. But there are key differences in how that authority is worded now. In SB 1198, destruction was limited to bees or articles, quote, found outside of a licensed or quarantine area, end quote. House Bill 1277 expands that language to say the department can seize, treat, or destroy any pollinator plant or regulated article if they determine it's necessary to prevent, control, or eradicate a pest or pathogen. There's still no list of specific diseases or pests or pathogen that justify that destruction. That means that this standard is entirely subjective. If they find a pest that could cause harm, even something as common as a small hive beetle, they have full legal authority to destroy your hive without prior notice or compensation. Now, again, I'm not expecting that anybody who is in a position like this, who is hopefully at least some level of passion towards honeybees and beekeeping, is going to be this way. But I absolutely know and aware and are aware of and have seen times where the wrong people are in the wrong job and they abuse that authority. I don't think it's likely to happen, and I don't think it's going to happen very often, but I guarantee things like this will absolutely happen if you give them that level of power and control. Now, the current bee law, which this bill is going to be repealing and replacing, it requires written notice and gives you a chance to treat or correct the issue before destruction. That protection completely disappears under House Bill 1277. The other concern here is the phrase, quote, regulated article, end quote. That term isn't limited to bees. It includes hives, equipment, boxes, feeders, possibly even stored honey. All of that could be seized or destroyed if the department says it's connected to a pest issue. So in short, this section of the bill replaces cooperation and notice with enforcement and destruction authority. It shifts the tone drastically away from, you know, education and cooperative disease management to full-on compliance and policing. The countdown is on. Holiday shopping season is officially here. Uncommon Goods takes the stress out of gifting with thousands of unique, high-quality finds you won't see anywhere else. Don't wait. The most meaningful gifts get scooped up fast, and now's the perfect time to cross names off your list. While browsing their site, I came across a DIY working cuckoo clock kit inspired by Alice in Wonderland. It looks like a fun project to build with kids, something that's hands-on and actually turns into a real working clock when you're done. What a unique gift idea. Uncommon Goods looks for products that are high quality, unique, and often handmade or made in the U.S. Many are crafted by independent artists and small businesses, making every gift feel meaningful and truly one of a kind. They have something for everyone, and when you shop at Uncommon Goods, you're supporting artists and small independent businesses. With every purchase, they give back $1 to a nonprofit partner of your choice, with over 3.1 million donated so far. So don't wait, cross those names off your list before the rush. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/honey. That's uncommongoods.com/honey for 15% off. Uncommon Goods, we're all out of the ordinary.
Support for this podcast is brought to you by Walden University. Ever catch yourself thinking, what if I could go after what I actually want and really make a difference? You're not alone, and that's exactly why I want to tell you about Walden University. For over 50 years, Walden has helped working adults like you get the W, with the knowledge and skills to build the future you want and make a difference where it matters most. If you've been waiting for the right moment, this is it. Head to waldenu.edu and take that first step. Walden University, set a course for change, certified to operate by CHEV.
Now, talking about some fees and verification programs and a few other areas of financial expansion, under the old bee law, registering your apiary was $10 per applicant. It was a flat, simple, you know, predictable fee structure. There were no recurring or scaled fees, no link to what you sold or you produced. With SB 1198, the 2024 version, it introduced the idea of replacing that with sort of a flexible licensing system. It had some of those optional verification types of programs, certain programs you could be a part of, you know, guaranteed to be treatment free or guaranteed to have some sort of a certification associated with it. And those things were going to ultimately be tied to some type of a fee, a percentage of gross sales, something like that. House Bill 1277, the 2025 version, it keeps that same structure but strengthens the department's control over how the money flows. The new bill specifically directs that all fees, charges, and assessments collected under these programs be retained by the department in a dedicated account rather than deposited into the state's general fund. That's a huge change. That gives the agency direct financial independence to expand programs without additional legislative appropriations. The bill also adds new enforcement language linking payment to those fees to license status. So if a participant fails to pay, the department may suspend or revoke the beekeeper's license until payment is made. That tie-in between finances and licensing was not explicit in SB 1198. Now, the percentage of gross sales concept, it does remain in the HB 1277, but it clarifies that those are only those who are to participate in those verification and certification programs, not to all license holders. So if you don't sell products under a verified label of some sort, like we just discussed, or as we discussed in the previous episode, you're not going to be affected by that provision. But supporters are framing these updates as like cost recovery measures that modernize the funding model. Someone on the more critical side of it sees it as creating a self-funding regulatory machine that can raise and retain money with minimal outside oversight. So you got to kind of pick which side of that battle you want to be on. But the bottom line is that the idea of the verification programs, not new. How the money is moving absolutely is. And HB 1277 transforms the department from a fee-collecting agency into a self-financing one. Broader authority and direct ties to payments for, you know, again, for licensing and enforcement efforts. So moving over into some of the penalties and enforcement side of things, the penalty section is one of the more notables of the House Bill 1277. It definitely kind of tightens the screws a little bit compared to last year. Both bills authorize civil and criminal penalties, but the 2025 version adds those daily fines and clarifies enforcement powers that were not spelled out before. So under House Bill 1277, like I briefly mentioned earlier, anyone violating this act or its regulation can be fined up to $500 a day for each violation and each day that it continues. So the per day clause did not appear in the 2024 version. It changes a one-time penalty into a running meter that can add up pretty fast. And I would really like to know where they come up with these numbers. Like, what average small-time beekeeping operation with 5, 10, 20, 100 hives just has $500 a day laying around to throw towards this fee? Like, why would they think that that's even reasonable for a government entity to essentially tax you without due process? They've made an accusation. You're like, okay, well, let's go to court. And you're getting charged $500 a day for 60 days until you get to have your day in court. And if you're right, cool. They, you know, get rid of that fee. And if you're wrong, you owe them like $15,000 or $20,000. I'm not sure if I can get on board with that. The new bill also adds some explicit misdemeanor language for interfering with or obstructing or refusing to comply with an order from the department. That covers everything from ignoring a stop order to refusing access during an inspection. Now, the original version, the 1198, it already made interference unlawful, but House Bill 1277 makes it criminally enforceable and adds language that could, in theory, apply to verbal resistance or non-cooperation, even if the beekeeper hasn't committed a direct violation. And it expands what counts as non-compliance. So under the 2025 bill, failing to pay the fees, maintaining records, submitting required documentation, any of these things can trigger suspension or revocation of your license. I mean, it could be something as simple as a paperwork issue or somebody just missed something somewhere to escalate into a loss of your status as a, you know, licensed operating business. Like, you may be in a suspended or revoked status because somebody made a mistake in a, you know, administrative kind of function. The bill's appeals and due process section has not changed much, which is part of the problem as well. There's no clear timeline for appeals or an automatic stay of enforcement while appeal is pending. Again, as I mentioned before, if you get fined, quarantined, or have things destroyed, there's no guarantee that the process stops while you're contesting it. That's a big concern. So when you take all these together, it really is shifting, as I mentioned before, the tone away from the like kind of administrative oversight into a legal enforcement. And I think that, you know, where if you look back to 1198, that left room for some cooperation and some correction, whereas House Bill 1277 defines compliance much more narrowly, and it gives the department broader legal, I think, leverage to punish noncompliance. Now, if you're someone who is supporting this legislation, you're going to say, hey, this is just accountability. This is great. But it effectively is raising the stakes for every beekeeper, especially small ones, by treating all violations as potential enforcement actions instead of teachable moments. You know, imagine being like a small-time beekeeper, 2, 3, 4, 5, whatever hives. You're just trying to enjoy nature, be a part of things, get a little honey for your family, have some fun, do some things with your kids. You know, just a nice, fun thing. And next thing you know, you've got some legal person breathing down your neck because you didn't file a piece of paperwork around your monthly, quarterly, yearly reports and your notes or something stupid. Like, come on. Okay, now one of the quieter changes, this is talking about how broad the authority is, like statewide. One of the kind of quieter changes between 2024 and 2025 shows up towards the end, where House Bill 1277 defines the department's authority as, quote, exclusive jurisdiction, end quote, over plants, pest, and pollinator health across the state. So that language is subtle, but it definitely makes a difference because it effectively preempts local governments from adopting their own apiary or pest control ordinances that might conflict with the state's policies. So in the past, local beekeeping associations, you know, county conservation districts, some of those kind of worked hand in hand with inspectors to address regional issues or, you know, small hive beetle, invasive plants, whatever it might be. House Bill 1277 removes much of that flexibility by centralizing the authority inside the department. That means if a local municipality or county wanted to pass an ordinance limiting hive density per residential lot or restricting the number of colonies in urban neighborhoods or setting their own pesticide education or outreach requirements, the department could overrule it under the claim of exclusive jurisdiction. The 2024 bill did have some similar wording, but House Bill 1277 adds new preemption language that extends beyond bees to cover the plants, pollinators, and any regulated article. So that puts nearly anything under one statewide system. So again, it's one of those things where on paper, it's supposed to create a nice, consistent way of managing and controlling things and regulating things. But in practice, I think it's consolidating too much of that control in Harrisburg, and it really limits how much the local communities can tailor them to their own environments. Like what's going on in Harrisburg, Pittsburgh, you know, Wilkes-Barre or whatever, some of these larger places is vastly different from what's going on in rural Pennsylvania. And this is what's happening in every state, right? Like Northern Virginia and Richmond and Charlottesville, like those are not the same values, beliefs, things that people hold dear as the people in rural parts of Virginia, right? It's a problem really that we're seeing on a national scale between completely different sets of beliefs, values, and all of that. But that's kind of going off onto a little bit of a sidebar. But I guess the key takeaway with it is just finding some way to say, look, I don't know that we need to centralize everything. We'll maintain an overarching body of regulation, but I still believe that things need to be pushed locally. It's almost like the federal government telling every state everything that they have to do. The states really should be doing most of that with just some support by the federal government, not as much kind of unilateral authority. But again, there's going to be like a ripple effect, I think, with this too, with education and outreach, because under the current system, local inspectors and extension agents, they have a lot of latitude to collaborate directly with beekeepers. And then centralizing that authority could definitely mean that those efforts now flow through state level protocols instead of local discretion. Sort of that kind of spirit of the law versus letter of the law type of thing. The overall message from that section, though, is that department isn't just regulating things. It is positioning itself as the sole authority over all pollinator-related matters in Pennsylvania. And I think that that is a major cultural shift from that cooperative community-based approach that's been in place in the state for decades. Okay, so trying to bring everything full circle. You know, when we started the discussion last week with Senate Bill 1198, and now you've seen how that has kind of evolved into House Bill 1277 with some stronger enforcement, more centralized power, and a structure that really gives Department of Agriculture some financial independence to expand its own reach. Again, you know, on paper, I think that a lot of the intentions are good intentions. I don't believe there are a lot of malicious people out there saying, hey, I've got an idea. Let's push this thing through and take control, you know, with the whole like evil villain, you know, with their fingers interlaced, you know, kind of thing. I don't think that's what's going on. And I recognize that they want to modernize things and protect pollinators and maybe streamline some management. But when you look at things that are contained in this and you look at them closely, you can really see how much of that authority is shifting towards the state and how little protection that there is for individual beekeepers, especially small scale backyard beekeepers who are just trying to have fun and do the right thing. So, I mean, you guys know me, right? I'm not a huge fan of excess government being involved in anything because I am a firm believer that everything that the government touches finds a way to break. Or if nothing else, they at least overcomplicate it and make it, you know, so many layers of bureaucracy that it's great to stimulate the economy and create a whole lot of new jobs, but it's really not great for the overall well-being of the $38 trillion in debt or whatever it is. But again, I'm not saying that suggesting we throw this whole thing out and say, hey, just start all over. This is a bunch of crap. There's a lot of things in there that I think could be worked with and worked around and tweaked and tuned and all of that. But we got to get out of this kind of like authoritarian legislative mindset. Like, I don't understand why multiple government entities throughout just keep trying to take more and more power. It doesn't make a lot of sense. But for you as the individual citizen, what you should know is that the bill has not passed. It's still relatively early in the process. It had that big reset with 2025. So the 2024 one I was discussing last week, very applicable, probably 90% of it. But the 2025 portion, it is still sitting in committee right now, which means if you want to voice your opinion and you want things to change, now is the time. Reach out to your local reps, people within the state. If you're a part of a club, get people in the club involved, talk to the other members. Definitely reach out to anyone that is listed as being on the House Agriculture and Rural Affairs Committee. Tell them where you stand on that. Ask them to clarify how it's going to affect small beekeepers and how it's going to protect you, and ask, see where you can put your input before, the department ends up getting a lot of unchecked authority, if nothing else. But be professional, right? Don't send them a message and be like, you guys are a bunch of, don't get wild and crazy. Just be very objective and stay to the facts and say, hey, I have a lot of concerns and here's what they are and what's the plan around this. But as I mentioned earlier, a lot of states are going to look at this as a model and it's going to be a little bit harder to pull back. So definitely make your voice heard. So to kind of wrap everything up, I guess if I could wrap it up within a couple of sentences, I would say that, being a responsible beekeeper, it's so much like many other things. It's like you have a few people that ruin it for everybody else, right? Just because one or two or 10 or whatever number of people in a state have done things in the wrong way or in a poor way, it doesn't mean we should penalize and punish the whole state. Put things in place that make sense. Put things in place that incentivize people to do the right thing. But putting excessive fees and fines and over-regulating, these things just aren't necessary. You can put together a great Plant and Pollinator Protection Act without taking away rights. And then you on the beekeeper side, you need to make sure you're doing the right thing and you're helping educate your friends and neighbors and that your bee club is advocating in the right way to make sure that everybody is doing things in accordance with best practices so that you don't have a reason for the government to want to take control. I saw like someone had posted a comment on a video and they were like, hey, I buy all kinds of bee gear at reduced prices at farm auctions. And it's like, hey, that's really cool that you're getting a good deal. But you got to remember, like, American foul brood is transmitted inside of bee gear. If you have used bee gear, you can run it through the wash machine, dishwasher, whatever you want to do. It's not going to kill the foul brood. Those spores can stay active for 50, 60 years. So, you got to be really careful and make sure you're doing best practices and you're teaching each other how to do things right. Stay informed, stay active, stay engaged, and just make sure that you're doing everything you can to protect your rights. So that's going to wrap it up for today, folks. As always, thank you so much to everyone who participates in the Buy Me a Coffee. Everything is funded by you guys. And we can't do it without you. So we really appreciate that. Links for that are inside the description. If you have any questions about this or anything else, feel free to drop me an email, jeff@beekeepingfornewbies.com. It's newbies.com. And the website is down, so I don't know what to say about that right now. But you can join us at the Discord room as well. And again, this web thing really is driving me nuts. I've never, ever had a website be down like this. And here, you guys probably heard me talking about my shift from GoDaddy over to this new platform. And I was super excited about it. I've had no issues with it. And now all of a sudden they want to start failing me. But anyway, take care, be kind to one another. Remember that I love you. There's nothing you can do about it. We'll talk to you soon.